Dr. Bright says none. Now, and this I think is directly related to the overall process of globalization. There are 33 million non-immigrant entries. Now, many fewer entries of persons. Many of the non-immigrant entries represent people who enter the United States multiple times. And there's still a much larger number if you add in Canadians and Mexicans. Now, by and large, if you think about that incredible number, by and large, the policy is very successful in ensuring that most of these non-immigrant entries return home. And most, in fact, stay for relatively short periods of time. But there is a very sharp increase in the number of long-term non-immigrants. So students and exchange visitors were really the kind of initial wave of this, but increasingly there has been the growth of temporary migration programs, most notably temporary migration programs for highly skilled workers. So of course that is the that has been a very important force in Silicon Valley. High technology industries and companies have pushed very strong for the expansion of temporary worker programs, but there was very significant interest in temporary and growth in temporary migration programs among low-skilled workers as well, especially in agriculture. Now, what's important to remind oneself from a kind of migration management perspective is that all of these programs to bring temporary workers, especially temporary high-skilled workers, involve families as well. That probably one can bring agricultural worker can have a temporary program for agricultural workers only, but one cannot have a temporary migration program for computer software engineers without allowing them to bring their families. So from a kind of policy program, non-immigrant migration is different from legal immigration or undocumented immigration, but from a social perspective, it's really very much the same. So, we don't actually know how many of the non-immigrants end up staying permanently, but the best estimate is that about half a million, there's a net addition to the overall immigrant stock of about half a million every year. Now, so what does this all add up to? And I think what it adds up to, I think, is the truth that certainly no politician, no public figure is willing to say to the American public, namely, that net immigration to the United States is 1.8 million. And it looks like this. That is, it's largely legal immigration. It's largely, I mean, again, the kind of non-immigrant flow is a legal flow. So looking at from the broader perspective, you say, well, the kind of immigration or immigration control system is very successful. Almost three quarters of the persons coming in through legal channels are coming in legally. But that's a very big number. And I think it's a big number that no one is willing to hear and no one is willing to set. And I think that the one reason why it's important to think about these three different components of the migration system is that that's what the comprehensive immigration reform that died in the last Congress tried to deal with. So, I mean, those of you kind of familiar with the details of this will recall that in the early days of the Bush administration, the Fox government was negotiating with Bush and was on the verge, let's say on September 5th, September 6th, 2001, of kind of negotiating what they were thinking of or describing as the big enchilada, which they thought of a program that would involve legalization, temporary worker program, an increase in the number of visas allocated to Mexican legal immigrants. But what Congress tried to do last summer was really represented a much, much bigger enchilada, not simply to deal with Mexican migration, but to try to deal with all of these different components of the migration system. And in the end, I think that one can understand why they wanted to do that, but in the end, I think that helps account for why the effort was doomed. So I'll talk briefly about policy and then segue to Joe.
Yeah, you can.
So, I mean.
You've gone about a half hour.
Okay.
Less, actually,
okay.
So you
fine.
Have about 40 minutes.
Okay. So, I mean, I think the way to understand the politics of immigration, and here I'm not saying anything original at all, is that this is the politics of strange bedfellows. And that is to say, there are kind of two coalitions, a coalition that has been characterized as an immigrationist coalition and a coalition that has been characterized as a restrictionist coalition. And what is striking about both of these coalitions is that they split right and left down the middle, so that the immigrationist coalition is, on the one hand, a kind of left-leaning coalition of cosmopolitans, of ethnic advocacy groups, and to some extent of labor unions. I would say that what is striking about the immigration politics of the 2000s is that labor unions have moved more into the kind of immigrationist camp than ever before, but the issue of how to control, how to manage immigration continues to divide the American labor movement. So the AFL-CIO and most of the important components of the Change to Win coalition ended up having very different views of the comprehensive immigration reform bill. The Change to Win unions were more likely to favor it, the AFL-CIO more likely to oppose it, largely because it would have entailed a temporary migration program. That is to say, the idea was to take that, find a way of taking, of converting that unauthorized flow into a temporary, something that would, a temporary flow of legally managed migration.
Like the Bracero program.
Like the Bracero program. Now, the restrictionist coalition is, again, it has a right-left component. The right consists of nativists, social conservatives. Of course, the core of the Republican base, at least the voting core, is to be found in the restrictionist coalition. The kind of the business core is to be found in the expansionist coalition. Historically, unions have been on the restrictionist side of the strange bedfellow coalition, and as I just said, that to some extent has been eroded. But I think there is no question that the bulk of American union members still very strongly favor restrictionist policies. So whereas their leaders have marched into the immigrationist camp, the union members remain very, very much in the restrictionist camp. All right. So let me just—I'll go very quickly through through the major policy changes. In a sense, immigration was transformed by the Hart-Celler Act of 1965, which ended country of origin quotas that had impeded immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe, had more or less barred immigration from Asia. The legislators assumed that what would happen was that immigration would magically recommence where it had ended in 1924. So somehow or another, there would be tens of thousands of people coming from Italy, Yugoslavia, Poland, what have you. Well, of course, that isn't what happened. It's a sudden spike of immigration from Europe that sort of quickly dried up, and what eventuated instead was large-scale immigration from Asia, and the fact that citizens could bring over their immediate relatives without any limitation very quickly allowed Asian immigration to grow. There was this other paradoxical effect, though, of the legislation that was completely unanticipated at the time, namely that migration from the Americas was capped. There was a worldwide limitation set on legal immigration. And so paradoxically, the same policy change that facilitated Asian migration impeded legal migration from Mexico. Now, that change took place exactly when the Bracero program was ended. So we don't have a good number, maybe Raul might know, of the number of total persons who entered the United States as Braceros. We know how many contracts were let, but you know, many of the Bracero workers came in under multiple contracts, multiple entries. But it was a large flow, and it was essentially ended without putting any alternative into place. So one had experience of roughly a little over 20 years in which networks were developed linking particular places in Mexico to particular places in the United States. Employers in the United States learning how to activate this immigrant to activate these immigrant networks. The legal framework was ended, but the social networks persisted, and for peculiar reasons that I'm not going to go into, the immigration bureaucracy essentially turned a blind eye to the conversion of the kind of legal temporary program into an undocumented program. So that two things took place at the same time. On the one hand, the legal framework for temporary Mexican migration was abandoned, and at the same time, legal immigration was made more difficult. And as soon as this happens, certainly by the late 1960s, one begins to have the emergence of a kind of illegal alien social problem. Whether it's a real problem or not, that's another story, but it's certainly identified as a social problem. Undocumented immigration then rises from the middle of the 1960s through the 1970s, reaching roughly, I would say, roughly 4 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States in the 1980s. And so Immigration Reform and Control Act was passed in 1986, and as I say here, it represents a triumph of the right-left coalition, but it was an effort, or at least it seemed to be an effort, to respond both to the preferences of the immigrationists, but also the restrictions. So how did it respond to the preferences of the immigrationists? Well, by legalizing a large proportion of the undocumented population, but not legalizing all of them. And I think that, again, is an important policy failure. So those persons allowed to legalize had to be resident in the United States up until 1982. So that, of course, left 1986, all the persons that had migrated from between 1982 and 1986 were ineligible to live in to legalize. Living in the United States, having roots in the United States, working in the United States, but essentially consigned to enduring undocumented status. At the same time, there was a special amnesty for agricultural workers. And this was instigated as a result of the efforts of our former senator and former governor, Pete Wilson. And this ended up providing a very significant door to a population much larger than anticipated, largely because of the way in which the program is administered allowed large numbers of immigrants to claim legal status when most likely they would not have been allowed to do so according to the strictures of the law. Now, the other side of the deal was to impose controls both on flows, but most importantly on employers' ability to access an undocumented flow. So for the first time, employers were required to verify that all persons who were hired were eligible to work in the legally eligible to work in the United States, and they were subjected to fines if they failed to comply with those strictures. So that's the grand compromise of IRCA. In the end, the results were very different than I think what many people at the time anticipated. Large-scale legalization and so what legalization? I mean, legalization again was good for the immigrants. There's no question about that. But one unanticipated consequence was that whereas the Mexican migration had long had the circular component in which large numbers of workers would come to the United States, go back to Mexico, come to the United States, what legalization did was to make it possible for their families to relocate entirely into the United States. So it kind of it led to a significant growth in the Mexican population living in the United States, but a much deeper, longer-term embedding of the immigrant population. Many of the legalized immigrants are naturalized, and that then allowed for above-ceiling migration. As I said, the IRCA had these two, had a variety of different aspects. One was legalization, but the other part, the other part was stiffer workplace and stiffer border control. So the combination of the kind of relocation of families and the tougher border enforcement changed what had been a at least partially temporary and circular phenomenon into a permanent phenomenon. That is, the more difficult it became to cross the border, the more those people who crossed the border decided that it was better to stay. Hard enough getting across once wasn't something that one would want to repeat the second time. The policy made it more difficult to get across the border, and so therefore the cost of hiring a specialist who could get you across the border increased. So here you see the rise in the cost of hiring a coyote. But the problem was, or the problem from a from a migration management perspective is that cost was absorbed by the immigrant Mexicans living in the United States. Very expensive for Mexicans living in Mexico, but affordable, perhaps painful, but affordable for Mexican immigrants living in the United States. Now, the key to the compromise was legalization on the one hand, but employer sanctions on the other. Well, not surprising that employer sanctions, which would have exacted significant pain, I think, on the employers of immigrants, were never meaningfully enforced. So here again, very dramatic illustration of the decline in the number of audits. And I mean, one can kind of look at this.
Huh? What is an audit?
Well, an audit is when somebody from the INS, what used to be the INS, I guess it would be now ICE, or I mean, one of the immigration agencies comes into your work list and says, well, I'd like to see who it is that you're employing and look at your books and so on. Right, right. So, now, whenever there have been, I mean, you read about this in paper that when there is a kind of intensification of workplace enforcement, very often, of course, it has very negative consequences for the undocumented workers who are employed in the places that are investigated. There was a raid in the San Fernando Valley, I think, 2 weeks ago. The immigrants, that's not who policy is responding to. Policy is responding to the employers of undocumented immigrants who are very, very unhappy and speak loudly when these things happen. A key to the legislation was this compromise between the kind of immigrationists and the restrictionists. In the end, the immigrationists principally got what they wanted. Okay. Another thing that happened was that spending and enforcement on border control increased. Although again, you can see the disparity between border control and interior control, all of which had the consequences of impeding illegal entries into the United States. Now, made it more difficult, but didn't make it more possible. The consequence of the making entry more difficult was simply to discourage people from returning. Okay, so. Let me now just talk about comprehensive immigration reform that died in the last Congress. Now, again, this represented, in some ways, like IRCA, a compromise between pressures for restriction and pressures for expansion. But I think that what's striking about looking at the comprehensive immigration reform bill that died in the last Congress is the degree to which it reflects a shift in the immigrationist coalition from the left to the right. That this is essentially a bill that would have done one thing that the left wanted, which was to provide partial legalization to 11, 12, 13 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States, but at the price of changing legal and temporary migration systems in ways that would have favored the right wing of the expansion of the immigrationist coalition. And the need, I think, on the one hand, to obtain the support of the right wing component of the immigrationist coalition, and on the other hand, to respond to the public clamor for stiffer enforcement was a legalization proposal that I think, by certainly comparative standards, was very ungenerous and could have produced, I think, a long-term expansion in a kind of guest worker population. So, I mean, here I have just itemized the major components of the legalization proposal of the time, but the key point is that legalization, unlike IRCA, which provided almost an instantaneous transfer from undocumented status to legal permanent residency, what the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill would have done would have been to essentially shift undocumented immigrants to a to the status of temporary migrants, that is, with the right to remain in the United States, with the right to go home, but no guarantee of movement to the next step. And in the last version of the bill that was introduced, movement to the next step was not only predicated on what the immigrants would do, that is to say, to learn English, and of course to pay for this process. I mean, that's clearly, you know, a very powerful idea in Washington, that is, instead of sending home remittances, let the immigrants, if they can do that, let them pay for legalization. Let the program essentially be self-funded. But the second step towards true legalization was really contingent on implementation of much more stringent control programs. Now, given the difficulty of implementing some type of secure ID, implementing effective employer sanctions, I think one can reasonably ask oneself whether this wasn't tantamount to a de facto guest worker program. Now, my sense is that most of the immigrant advocates were willing to settle for it. That is to say, de facto guest worker, just the right to live in the United States under more or less legal circumstances, was worth virtually any price. But in my view, this was a very heavy price indeed. Now, the other component, and here I think one is seeing the influence of the kind of right-wing part of the immigrationist coalition, is to kind of shift the preference category. So that is the legal immigration policy that emerged from the 1965 Act and onwards essentially gave preference to the relatives of American citizens and American permanent residents. Well, the kind of right-wing component of the immigrationist coalition has other objectives, namely facilitating occupational migration, in particular the kind of migration of the best and brightest, but immigration also of workers willing to do the 3D jobs of difficult, dangerous, dirty when appropriate. So this bill would have essentially come close to emulating the Canadian system, putting in place a point system that, as you can see, would have facilitated the migration of highly skilled workers, but would have made it very difficult for typical immigrants from El Salvador, from Mexico, from the Caribbean, to enter the United States under as legal immigrants. And then, in addition, the bill would have provided a formal guest worker program, so a formal program for temporary workers. And with the stipulation that it would involve regular rotations, that it would not be a portal to long-term legal migration. Now, I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at this bill, what one sees, I think, is patent, is this compromise between the kind of left immigrationists, who are principally, I think, seeking legalization, but have long sought to preserve family migration, and their need to compromise with the right component of the immigrationist coalition under circumstances in which the American public, in part swayed by manipulation in the media, wants increasingly stringent controls. And I think so. What that eventuated in was a bill that ultimately was unsuccessful, in part because it tried to produce this big, I guess, unswallowable enchilada. But a bill that I think would have satisfied principally the preferences of the business or the right wing component of the immigrationist coalition. So, to end, so this simply summarizes this, and right. So the legalization for the left employers. I mean, the one thing I do want to back up and say, and that is one thing that is striking about the politics of the comprehensive immigration reform is the degree to which employers were committed to legalization. And clearly there was an effort to try to peel off the employer component to go along with a combination of tougher border control and temporary worker programs. But given the large size of the undocumented population, employers are now dependent on that immigrant workforce and want to do this. Okay, to sum up. It seems to me the kind of what we Well, what we experience, I think, today is principally a cleavage on the right. But I think that's a decisive cleavage because on the immigration issues, the left is not particularly powerful, not particularly persuasive. So what business wants is an overall reform. It doesn't just want to deal with the with legalization. It wants to try to reorganize, improve the management of the overall immigration system of all of its components. But notwithstanding this unusual left-right, this left-right coalition, the kind of the combination of a weakened president and the vehement opposition of the Republican social conservative base ended up killing the killing comprehensive immigration reform. I think the question for tomorrow is, you know, is whether it's possible to do any better. I mean, it's here it's pure speculation, but it's very difficult for me to imagine that the Republicans who were unwilling to support Bush will help either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama legalize, change the legal immigration system, or do something about temporary workers. It's hard to see what's in it for them. Now, maybe that the best bet for undocumented workers, as much as I hate to say this, is the election of John McCain. I think John McCain could possibly do what Bush couldn't do. But he may also run into the same problem. So this is, well, we will all find out. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Roger. Okay, I'm very pleased to be able to introduce our second presenter, Joel Fetzer from the Department of Political Science at Pepperdine. Joel has worked on a lot of interrelated aspects of immigration, xenophobia, repression of people coming from abroad. His book, Muslims in the State in Britain, France, and Germany, was about essentially that kind of question of the different, comparing the way in which the state in these different countries deals with the immigrants, their religious practices, you know, provides a comparative framework and, you know, compares these. He's currently working on more historical study on the effect, the realities and effects of xenophobic violence and state repression in American history in the 19th and early part, I guess, of the 20th century. So without further ado, thanks very much for coming, Joel.
First of all, the sort of four parts to what I want to cover today. First, I think I'll just begin by...
Did everybody get to have the handout?
Yeah, I have a sort of an outline plus two regression tables. I think I'll start by looking at sort of the Bush-era immigration policy in historical perspective, so Bush versus Clinton, and then, you know, possibly I can engage in more speculation about what a post-Bush immigration policy would look like. The second topic I'd like to look at are basically the determinants of public opinion towards immigration in the United States. So partly based on a regression I just did, and then where some of the variables aren't really available in those data from 2005, we'll look at just sort of the broader literature on immigration attitudes. The third topic I'd like to look at are the votes in the House of Representatives for H.R. 4437, which was a very harsh enforcement-only approach to immigration reform, which passed the House but then failed later, at least as a whole, it failed in the Senate. So we'll look at why.
When was that, John?
I believe it was 2005, December 2005. So why did people vote for or against it? And then finally, just in a fairly superficial way, like to look at sort of the winners and losers under the current immigration policy, so status quo immigration policy. And, you know, some of this I'm just going to sort of go over very quickly. And if you want, you know, sites or details, you could, you know, ask in the question and answers or email me later. Okay, So before getting engrossed in other matters, I'd like to just answer this question, the major question of the colloquium. So first of all, did Bush's immigration policies differ from Clinton's? And here, obviously, I'm looking at W's as opposed to the first Bush. If you look at law relating to typical immigration, meaning largely Latin American, or at least typical from the perspective of maybe Los Angeles, there hasn't actually been that much change. Clinton, you remember, was the one who initiated Operation Gatekeeper in 1994, which was actually quite harsh. A lot of people were encountered more difficulties entering the U.S. after 1994, and we can look at that a little bit later. Clinton doubled the size of the Border Patrol, or at least doubled the size of the Border Patrol, partly in 1996. And he also signed, you know, whether his heart was in it or not, it was an election year, and so he signed, in the end, the 1996 IRIRA and immigration reform legislation, which was basically in a restrictionist direction, not a fairly liberal piece of legislation as a whole. Bush has not, because he's been basically occupied with 9/11 and the war in Iraq, he has not been able to pass any major immigration legislation since he took office. There were certainly attempts, and I think if, as Roger said, comprehensive immigration reform had gone through, you know, 2-3 years ago, then conceivably we could have said, well, maybe, you know, you could have made the argument that either they were exactly the same or Bush was even slightly more liberal on immigration policy than Clinton had been. Probably the biggest change, though, under the Bush administration is, I think, the wholesale deportation campaign of the last 2 years. Really, you know, it's not necessarily a change in the law per se, but it's a change in how it's acted out. So levels of deportations, immigration raids where people are just sort of, you know, even sort of pre-dawn type raids, existentially have been very jarring to the immigrant community, especially Latino community, in places like Los Angeles, and the levels of deportation are getting comparable to that seen in Operation Wetback of the 1950s, when we actually did go, sort of the INS did go through sort of house to house and deport people.
When did these start, John?
So this was the deportation about 2 years ago. So like there was the one in Van Nuys 2 weeks ago, which they had like 100 agents and, you know, people are deported, the parents are deported, and, you know, there's still small children at home, many of them native-born U.S. citizens, just really gripping human tragedies based on some of these immigration raids. This increase in the wholesale deportation, some people argue that it's a kind of, Bush is trying, the Executive Department is trying to get back for the failure to pass comprehensive immigration reform by Congress. So it's like, okay, fine, if you can't give me what I really wanted, which is comprehensive immigration reform, then I'll show you exactly how difficult it's going to be. And so they start deporting people. These deportations, in turn, have sparked the creation of a new sanctuary movement. So remember, there was a sanctuary movement in the 1980s, largely trying to shelter undocumented refugees, depending on your perspective. From Central America, some of the civil wars in Central American region, putting them in synagogues and churches in certain localities. And so we have a new sanctuary movement now, which is doing very similar things, is not just about individual cases, it's also about a PR statement trying to change policy by changing public perceptions. Okay, so I think that's a difference. If you also look at policy towards immigrants from the Middle East. Now, I think clearly there is a difference under Bush as opposed to under Clinton. So if you look at the Patriot Act, you look at the mass deportation of Middle Eastern young men right after 9/11. I had a student in my immigration class right after 9/11, and he was constantly in and out of the INS's office. You know, they were basically trying to deport him because he was from Indonesia. It's been extremely difficult to get work, to get student visas post 9/11 if you're from a predominantly Muslim country, most of them from the Middle East, but also including Indonesia. Now, this is not to say that there was nothing of the kind under Clinton, but the scale and the sort of draconian effects have been much more important after 9/11, after Bush took office. You know, so some of the things Clinton did was, you know, actually try Middle Eastern nationals in basically deportation hearings, using secret evidence, using hearsay, using people that really couldn't be cross-examined, things which were, you know, generally contrary to what we would think of as a due process. Okay, so that's sort of Clinton versus Bush. Next, I'd like to also engage
that
in a little.
That was under Clinton, though.
Right, Clinton. That was under Clinton. So he started. I mean, certainly Bush has done that, I mean, you know, cubed. But Clinton was doing it even before 9/11. Next, post-Bush immigration policy. So what might things look like in 2009 and afterwards? I'm not by nature particularly optimistic. But I'm currently working a book looking at hate crimes. How many Chinese immigrants were beaten to death in the 1880s in anti-Chinese rioting in places like California? So I don't tend to look at subjects that are particularly pleasant or make one feel good about human nature. Nonetheless, I do see a couple bright spots for the immediate future. Here I'm speaking as a political scientist. Bright spot, at least from my perspective, is that the prospects for the GOP continuing to occupy the White House in, say, February of 2009, I don't think are particularly good. Maybe Roger's even more pessimistic than I am, but, there is some, a little faint cause for optimism, I think. So if you look at the approval ratings that came out about a week ago, 77% of Americans disapprove of Bush's performance as president. And, Bush II has de facto approved or endorsed McCain. So I think McCain is going to be tainted with sort of the Bush legacy, just as Gore was tainted in some ways with the Clinton legacy. They're both Republicans, and in many ways McCain is supporting a lot of the policies of the current Bush administration, especially in Iraq. In some ways he's sort of even more gung-ho, 100 years in Iraq, rather than Bush. Second, if you look at American history, as far as I know, no incumbent president, no incumbent party has ever won re-election during a recession. Bush can ask his father about that. I remember he was very popular, Bush the First was very popular during the Gulf War, immediately after the Gulf War, but then, in the depths of the recession, Clinton won following November. Next, if you look at various political economic models of the aggregate vote, the two-party vote for president in the United States. There are a lot of different models out there, but one I sort of like because it's quite parsimonious. There's sort of one major variable by Edward Tufte. It's kind of a classic. Looks just at percent change, or largely at percent change in real disposable income per capita. If you grind the data for using this model, the two-party vote that goes to McCain, so to the Republicans in November, making a certain assumptions, is 45%. Well, 45%, that's not a majority. So 55% would go to, the two-party vote would go to the Democrats, whoever the Democratic nominee will
be. So there's a proportion, the real disposable income change.
Right, so basically,
What period is it?
Well, okay, so it depends on how long you sort of cut the data. I mean, Tufte was looking at sort of the most recent, I think, quarterly data. And, his work came out in the 70s, so he was looking at sort of a shorter time span. I teach an intro to American politics class usually every year at Pepperdine, and just for laughs, we sort of grind this through and I try to update it and see what happens. So the best quarterly data I could get for the United States was fourth quarter of 2007, and that had a percent change in real disposable income of negative 0.177%, which, that's not positive. In Tufte's day, he said you needed 4% to be re-elected as an incumbent party. If you put that in, it comes out with basically McCain losing. This model, of course, is assuming it's valid when one of the candidates is a woman or when one of the candidates is an African American. And again, we don't have data for those. That assumption would have to hold. And we also would have to assume that the economy would stay the same or get worse between now and November. And, I think that maybe is a relatively safe bet. Okay, so another cause for optimism is that if you just sort of look at McCain versus Obama in the current polls, McCain loses again. So this suggests that maybe the Democrats are not in a hopeless state. Another positive indicator, at least electorally, is that religious right voters seem not to be particularly happy with McCain. So conceivably, they might stay home in November, or some of them even seem inclined to vote for Obama. There are sort of some Republicans evangelical Protestant Christians, people that you can see would not ordinarily think of as voting for a Democratic president, who would be more likely to vote for, say, Obama. You might even have a realigning election in 2008, although obviously every election seems to be warming up for a realignment, but then in the end, when you look at the data, there isn't much change. Okay, so if things are bad for the Republicans and we do get a Democratic president in 2009 and a solid Democratic majority in the Congress, then what would happen for immigration? I guess I would argue the chances for some sort of major immigration legislation would be relatively good. So if you think about some of the major electoral or legislative voting problems for McCain-Kennedy, the comprehensive immigration reform legislation in Congress, probably the most difficult problem was the Republican bloc in the House, who were, you know, pre-2006, who really did not want that to go through at all. You know, people like Sensenbrenner. On the other hand, electorally, there is, if you have a Democrat in the White House, if you have a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate, there is an electoral reason in the long term to pass some sort of immigrant-friendly piece of legislation, especially Latino-friendly piece of legislation. So the Democrats want to make sure that Latinos continue to support the Democratic Party over the GOP. And so I think, you know, whichever party can win the loyalty of Latino voters in the long run will have a substantial electoral advantage in the next couple of decades. I mean, think about, you know, what Pete Wilson did to the Republican Party in California. If that could go nationally, then what would happen to the Republican Party nationally? Just sort of anecdotally, an N of one, parents of one of my students entered the U.S. From El Salvador in the early 1980s. They were refugees from the Salvadoran Civil War. And a few years later, they were legalized under IRCA. After they were legalized, they took a picture of Ronald Reagan. I mean, Ronald Reagan, like the Ronald Reagan, and put it up in their dining room. Okay, you know, working class Salvadoran refugees from the Civil War. It would be nice if the Democrats of the current generation of recently legalized, immigrants, put up pictures of Clinton, or more likely, given the current delegate count, Obama, sort of on their dining room wall, and that way they could continue to vote for the Democrats, at least from the perspective of the Democratic Party. And I think another problem for sort of not changing the immigration legislation is that in the long run, even a Democratic president is going to soon discover that the current enforcement situation is sort of undoable. I mean, you can't deport 12 million people. And at a certain point, it's simply ridiculous. You have to make some kind of legislative change. So possibly some sort of immigrant-friendlier version of McCain-Kennedy, of the comprehensive immigration reform, maybe without switching from a family-based to a skills-based system. And I think the argument there politically would be that if you want to curry favor with Latino voters or potential Latino voters, then it's probably better to maintain the family-based approach, which is probably what the majority of Latino voters would prefer over a skills-based system. If you think about the debate in, I believe, Austin last Thursday, both Clinton and Obama said that they supported comprehensive immigration reform, some sort of slow-motion earned legalization, possibly employer sanctions, maybe even real employer sanctions as opposed to just kind of generic ones, and probably some sort of increased border enforcement, although not necessarily a physical border wall at all parts of the border. Next, I'd like to look at some of the determinants of public attitudes towards immigration. Now, as Roger noted earlier, there's usually, almost always, historically in the United States and sort of comparatively in other countries, especially, say, in Western Europe or in Japan, there's a very large difference between your median sort of mass level public opinion on immigration and the elite public opinion, or at least elite actions. So in general, the public is very hostile to further immigration, and especially immigration increases. And the elite tend to be, for various reasons, much more immigrant friendly, or immigration friendly at any rate. OK, so if you look at the handout on table one, is this is an OLS regression that I ran on Friday, just using relatively recent data. These are 2005, ICPSR 4607. It's a survey by Gibson et al. Gibson's at WashU in political science. It was a national sample. What I wanted to do is just sort of illustrate the two major theoretical schools about immigration attitudes. So the first major school is sort of economic or material self-interest, and this is arguing that basically, you know, immigration hurts certain people, especially, say, unemployed people, people who are working class, and so they're the ones who are more likely going to go out and oppose further immigration. This school is actually not particularly well populated in the immigration attitudes field, but people like Rita Simon at American University and then Edwin Harwood at Hoover Institute was working this this vein as well, and they're basically following the theory of Anthony Downs, sort of economic theory of voting. The next second school is, there are various labels for it, but I've sort of, you could just sort of say generic non-material, you could say symbolic politics, cultural, race-oriented school. This tends to be much better populated and also usually slightly more methodologically sophisticated. And some representative scholars would be, say, Jack Citrin at Berkeley, Don Green at Yale, myself, and we generally tend to be following theories like those of David Sears, the idea of a sort of symbolic politics as opposed to sort of narrow material economic self-interest. Okay, so what do the data look like in just sort of 2005? The dependent variable is the standard: should the number of immigrants be increased a lot, down to decreased a lot? I believe it's a 5-point scale, and I coded it in a nativist direction. So in an anti-immigration nativist direction, where a high number, so say a 5, equals high levels of nativism. If you look at the first column, so it's a marked exogenous model, you can see the results for a series of material and then non-material exogenous variables. So as you can see, neither of the economic variables reaches statistical significance. So income is far from statistically significant. I don't have the standard errors here, but it's, you know, I have a little ABC, so I can assure you it's very far from statistical significance. Unemployment was slightly close. I think a p-value was like around 0.11, but even that didn't really cut it. The other problem with, you know, even if the p-value were, say, 0.001, the sign is wrong for the economic theory. So it's in an anti-nativist, pro-immigration direction, which seems very counterintuitive if you accept the economic model. It's similar to this Norwegian literature, which actually does get a statistically significant unemployment variable, but in the opposite direction. So being unemployed makes you more likely to support immigration, according to the Norwegian data. Okay, non-material variables seem to fare much better. So living in the South increases nativism. If you look at the South variable, being a naturalized citizen, being Latino, being African-American, interestingly enough, if you're from a religion other than Christianity, and if you're highly educated, you're on the average, everything else being equal, more likely to have low levels of nativism. Now, I've included education as sort of non-material or symbolic trait. There's some dispute in the literature, the immigration attitudes literature, about whether education is an economic or a cultural variable. So the argument is, you know, do you get education at college, especially, and then you're economically empowered, and so you feel, once you go out into the workforce, that you don't have to worry about largely working class immigrants taking your job. You know, if you have a PhD, there are relatively few PhDs coming into the U.S. From, say, Latin America, and so you're less likely to at least perceive that immigration is a problem for you. So that's the economic theory of education. The cultural theory is more that you learn racial tolerance, you learn multicultural, you learn about lots of different countries, you feel less culturally threatened the longer you stay in higher education. In the literature currently, immigration attitudes is still sort of making up its mind about this dispute. But there are probably more studies finding that education acts on immigration attitudes primarily through teaching about multiculturalism rather than through teaching job skills per se. And if you also look at the education coefficient in the exogenous model versus the full model, education is halved. The education coefficient is halved after you control for the sort of orientations, more sort of symbolic orientations down at the bottom, especially, say, anti-black prejudice and political conservatism. So if you look at education, it goes from, let's see, like -0.112 down to -0.065, so, you know, more or less half what it was in the first column. This suggests that education is more acting through multicultural learning than acquisition of job skills. The second column also includes more endogenous mediating or symbolic variables like anti-black prejudice, nationalism, party ID, political conservatism, and then generalized trust in other people. So this is a kind of Adorno-like argument. Of the controls listed, PID, nationalism don't have any independent effect, but racial prejudice and political conservatism do seem to boost nativism, with generalized trust reducing it. So overall, material self-interest does a pretty poor job of explaining mass level attitudes towards immigration. Now, of course, you could step back. And I remember I had a reviewer of my immigration attitudes book say, well, okay, in the short run, directly, you don't have economic effects, but you have to step back and say, well, what sort of economic structure is producing these culturally or racially based immigration attitudes? And I think you could make that argument, but you can't really do it too well with microdata the way I have here. So the broader immigration attitudes literature generally finds the same thing, reaches a similar conclusion to table one. Sometimes, however, you do find some small sociotropic effects. So your perceptions of the state of the national economy do sometimes, in certain models and certain economic conditions in the United States, change your attitudes, influence your attitudes about immigration. So if you think the economy is going down the tubes nationally, then you're more likely to want to restrict immigration multivariately. And sometimes you get occupational effects. So certain occupations, managerial occupations, tend to be more pro-immigration, everything else being equal. And then there are some studies which have significant effects for more working class occupations, where they're more likely to oppose immigration. If you look at the American Voter Study, some of the arguments there would suggest that economic variables might be more important during a recession than in the relatively prosperous year of this data set. So 2005 was relatively prosperous. You know, my guess is today you'd be more likely to get economic effects on immigration attitudes. Finally, on the, if you look at the immigration attitudes literature more broadly, and you look at over time, time series models, you know, in the United States it's hard to get, we don't really have very good time series data for immigration attitudes, and we don't arguably have an explicitly sort of Le Pen-style, National Front-style anti-immigrant party. So it's difficult to have a proxy for immigration attitudes over time. But in general, in countries like France, you do tend to get increases in nativism at the aggregate level per year or per quarter when you have the data as the RDIC declines. So basically, if people don't have money in their hands, they get upset, and they want to restrict immigration. The real disposable income per capita. So it's sort of like the Tufte model. It was interesting. I mean, in the French model, I ran a time series. You have very good French data on like support for Le Pen. There, if you put in like the percentage of immigrants in the population, the RDIC per capita, change in RDIC per capita, and the unemployment rate. Unemployment rate doesn't work out. It's not statistically significant. The number of immigrants in the population doesn't matter. But the change in real income does matter over time in an AREMA model for French data. You know, in the U.S., unfortunately, we don't have those kinds of data, and so there is a good reason why we don't have Le Pen type data, because we don't have a Le Pen type party. So that is good, at least for immigrants. But for social scientists, it's unfortunate that we don't have very finely nuanced quarterly data. Okay, economic effects don't seem to work out too well for immigration attitudes. Next, I'd like to look at more the elite level. And this is House members, House of Representatives members in December of 2005 when they were voting for H.R. 4437. Remember H.R. 4437, this was what sparked the immigration marches in places like Los Angeles. You had, arguably millions of people out in the streets nationally protesting.